two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Utah's best athletes count on flexibility, speed, strength.
And the Jazz pick up their 22nd assist.
So they count on University of Utah Health.
Brielle Soleil puts this game away.
And so can you. Leading doctors, a world-class environment, award-winning innovation, care to be great.
14 unanswered by the Utes.
University of Utah Health, caring for Utah's best and yours. Schedule your appointment now at uofuhealth.org/care to be great.
And Scotty, 97.5, the KSL Sports Zone, 207. Joining us now, Jazz B writer from the Salt Lake Tribune and overall good dude, Andy Larson, kind enough to join us. Andy, how are you?
Andy.
Good. How are you guys?
We are doing well. All right. So I had to go look at the Wikipedia page at Will Hardy. Do you feel like this guy does have the inside track to this Jazz coaching job?
You know, I do hear that's kind of the vibe right now is that there's, obviously they've interviewed a ton of candidates. They've given a second interview to a ton of candidates. But if you look at Will Hardy's resume and kind of what he's done with the Spurs organization, what he's, you know, obviously his time overlapped with Quinn Snyder with the Spurs and then, last year with the Celtics, I think his Team USA as well. I think it's a good hire. You know, the word is, Mark Stein reported last week that the Jazz were kind of leaning towards an assistant coach rather than going towards someone who had had previous head coaching experience like a Frank Vogel or a Terry Stotts. Kind of a young assistant coach like Will Hardy, like Kevin Young, like, heck, even Johnny Bryant was kind of the way that the Jazz were thinking with his reporting. And I've heard personally that, Will Hardy is kind of really highly considered after his first couple of interviews.
So I've been talking about this, Andy, just looking at the different candidates and the hiring process, the communication between the organization and the different potential hires. It feels like they're really running their due diligence. And I keep thinking to myself, if there was a guy, this is the question. If there was a guy that came in and just knocked this interview out of the park, do you think we could just see a quick hire or do you think we're in for a lengthy process?
I think they want to build a coaching staff too. So I think those are some of the things that are playing a role in this, and Danny Ainge was pretty clear that this would be a lengthy process. And nor do I think that there's really an upside to hiring now versus 2 weeks from now. I don't know that you're going to get anyone different with the taxpayer mid-level exception if you have a coach in place versus if you don't. And, I think there's always the chance that, one guy could just wow you and say, hey, that's the guy. But I also think that you probably want to continue to do your due diligence no matter who or what if that happens. So, you want to talk to the people who've worked with Will Hardy over the last decade, and you want to talk to the players who have played under him, and have they improved? You want to talk to him about player development. You want to have him meet Ryan Smith and ownership. There's just kind of a lot of steps in this process because they do want it to be a collaborative one, because they do want to hire a coach that's not just going to be around for 1 or 2 years, but 4, 5, 6. And I think there's a lot of kind of factors that they want to think through. So, you know, it's, even if Will Hardy blows it out and I, you know, it blew his interview out of the water and did a great job. And I think that's what I've heard, that has happened. You still want to do the proper work in order to make that hire.
So I think there's a lot of people out there that, Phil, and maybe this is the case and maybe it's not. You can clarify on this a little bit, that you hire a head coach and then you give him a assistant coaching pool of money and say, okay, now go divvy it up and go build your staff. Is that going to be the case here, or will the Jazz and Danny Ainge also be involved in a certain number of assistants will be part of the staff?
It totally depends, right? Like, and that's one of the things that's very much up for negotiation and coaching contracts. So, I mean, I'll just give you the example I'm most familiar with Quinn Snyder. At the beginning, he did not have full control over his coaching staff, right? Like, so he kept along some of the people from Ty Corbin's coaching staff, like Alex Jensen and Brad Jones. Obviously, kind of Johnny Bryant was working his way up in that sphere as well. And then, you know, by kind of midway through his tenure a few years ago, then when he did sign his next contract, yeah, then he was given kind of carte blanche to do whatever he wanted with his coaching staff, given the salary, right? And so you saw some kind of changes to the coaching, to that coaching staff as a result. And so, you know, I think that's kind of what we should expect with this, is I don't know that he would necessarily have carte blanche right away like Quinn Snyder kind of earned, but you know, certainly he's going to have say in that conversation. There's no doubt about that.
So, Andy, as we kind of look for things to evolve, we know that free agency starts July 1st. To kind of help everybody understand what that means, when July 1st rolls around, what does that mean to the Utah Jazz?
Well, and it's funny because this year they're pushing it forward to June 30th at, I believe it's 6 p.m. Eastern time. So that, you know, instead of having kind of midnight free agency like we're kind of used to, we get kind of these news breaking periods in the middle of the day. And the NBA was hoping essentially to get more eyeballs on the NBA when you have big news stories happen in the afternoon rather than at night. But, when that rolls around, I think we're going to hear conversations that the Jazz might be having. I think, honestly, as we've talked about all offseason long, the trade market is where the Jazz are going to be doing their business this offseason. And truthfully, you know, the taxpayer mid-level is not going to be the first thing that probably gets signed, you know, unless the Jazz want to kind of give that money to someone who is a reach for it or doesn't think they can get a better deal elsewhere. You know, usually you're signing taxpayer mid-levels 2-3 days into free agency, maybe even a week after free agency begins, because, you know, you're dealing with people who maybe have other better offers elsewhere. So, from a Jazz point of view, I don't expect like a lot of rapid changes. You know, there's no realistic path for them to get any more cap space than that. You know, I could see maybe a deal with like a Daniel House or something like that getting done relatively quickly. They do have to make a decision on Juancho Hernan Gomez's contract. But like, you know, I think for the most part, it's not going to be a exciting free agency period for Jazz fans, at least not in the free agency market. I think, again, it's the trade market that's going to be the bigger deal.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are. And this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I did want to circle back a little bit on the coaching staff. You mentioned, obviously, they're casting a wide net, and you kind of hinted at this. I just want to spend a little bit more time on it. So, like, let's say a guy like Jason Terry, obviously Bennett was in the league for a long time, currently in the G League. Is the purpose of his hire or of his interview, obviously they're going to give him a shot, and if he blows the Jazz away, he'd have an opportunity. But are they also interviewing some guys in particular, guys like that, as potential assistant coaches for this future staff?
Yeah, I think they will, and I think they are. You know, I obviously you want to give everyone the benefit of the doubt and a real shot at the number one gig, right? But the reality of it is, you know, you can't hire 15 candidates, and it depends really who you may hire as that head coach. Now, you know, if the reporting is wrong and they do want to go with someone with, you know, prior head coaching experience like a Terry Stotts or a Frank Vogel, then, you know, you have kind of those boxes checked. But if you are going with someone younger, like a Will Hardy or a Kevin Young or whoever, or Johnny Bryant, you know, someone 35 to 40 who's hasn't had that head coaching experience, you might prefer someone who has head coaching experience, you know, and you start to have conversations with people who do. And whether that's bringing on someone like a Mike D'Antoni as a coaching advisor, or again, a Terry Stotts or a Frank Vogel, or heck, even someone like Jason Terry, who has that G League coaching experience, you have conversations with Alex Jensen, you know, a former D League coach of the year. You know, you do really kind of start to put together, I think, a coaching staff that makes sense. And, you know, I also think that's not even just experience, but maybe what their resume says they're better at. So, for example, Kevin Young with the Suns, widely regarded as like an offensive mastermind, but maybe you want a defensive coach to work with him too. So maybe that's when you'd have a conversation with a Frank Vogel or maybe an Adrian Griffin, you know, someone who's really kind of renowned for their defensive qualities as well. And, you know, I think that's kind of an NFL way of thinking about it. But I do think you look at some of the successful coaching staffs around the league and you can kind of make a coaching staff that makes each other stronger by having different strengths in different parts of the, you know, kind of the game.
Andy, when the NBA draft came and went, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most surprised, how surprised were you that the Jazz did not make a move to get into the draft?
You know, if you'd asked me that question on Monday, like what the odds are last Monday before the draft on what I, you know, I thought the Jazz were kind of, and they had significant momentum towards making some sort of a deal. And I would, you know, said, hey, maybe there's a chance that they kind of bridged that gap, by the middle or the end or, you know, Thursday on draft day itself. By Thursday, my vibe was just very much that they were pretty far away from a deal, that, you know, there wasn't significant, you know, it was not that they were a small player or pick protections away in some of these trade negotiations. They were really significantly far away on their biggest goals, you know? So, you know, it still wouldn't have surprised me if they did a smaller move for a second round draft pick or something like that. Obviously that didn't happen. But in terms of like a Mike Conley or Rudy Gobert trade, they were pretty far away. And so I think that's, I can't say that I was super surprised when no trade happened. And again, you know, I think Danny Ainge is going to be really patient. You know, he is telling other front offices and it, you know, other front offices either do or don't believe this, but that they are willing to keep Rudy Gobert and that they are willing to keep Mike Conley and they are willing to kind of keep their guys rather than take a bad deal. And, you know, I like I said, some front offices believe that and some front offices think that that's just posturing, right? Like you obviously don't say, hey, we need to sell this guy right away. That being said, you know, obviously the pressure will ramp up in free agency. I think everyone's watching the Kevin Durant situation right now, the Kyrie Irving situation right now. And so are the Jazz, not necessarily to get Kevin Durant, but because, you know, if the Portland Trailblazers get Kevin Durant and all of a sudden, you know, the Western Conference is a whole lot harder and maybe that changes your perspective on what you're trying to do and what kind of deals you need to make. So, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a bad kind of urgency there where they felt like they needed to get a deal done on at the draft. You know, obviously that's when a lot of deals happen, but you also look around the league and say, hey, John Collins didn't get moved. Miles Turner, Malcolm Brogdon from Indiana didn't get moved. You know, there are just a lot of these guys who were in trade rumors all week that didn't get moved, you know, because I think these teams, you know, were not necessarily willing to budge on their asking prices.
So maybe let's just not beat around the bush here. Not saying that you are, but let's just be honest. Is there really value for what the Jazz have to offer right now in terms of, I mean, Royce O'Neal was not good last year. Mike Conley's old and has a bad contract. Rudy Gobert is owed, what, like $160 million at least over the next or $120-some-odd over the next 3 years. And if he opts, you know, picks up that fourth-year option, you know, nearly $160, $170 million. Is the demand for Jazz players just not as much as what maybe Jazz fans or Jazz front office think it is?
Frankly, yes. Like, yeah. I mean, that is the problem. And, you know, I think there are cases where it makes sense. You know, I think that Toronto and Atlanta and Chicago would love to change up their starting center. And Rudy Gobert is obviously the best one on the trade market. But it's also like, yeah, you got to pay him a lot. And yeah, he just turned 30 this weekend. And, you know, you got to put a good fit around him and play basketball in a certain way. And it doesn't work in a lot of situations. Mike Conley, I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, it's just is aging and had a really poor playoffs and has had injury concerns, you know, for the last couple of seasons. Like it probably just does not look like a positive contract. Even though, you know, the advanced stats on Mike Conley's performance during the regular season were great last year, it's just like, okay, can you still get much out of him? And, you know, obviously, yeah, Royce doesn't have a lot of trade value, like you said. I think the one guy who does have pretty significant trade value is, you know, Bojan Bogdanovic. And that's not to say Bogey has more trade value than Rudy Gobert or something like that, but there is a need for shooting in this league, and there is, you know, Bogey does have some defensive toughness at times. You know, he's shown that in the playoffs. He's obviously not like a rebounder or anything like that. But he's a guy that you can plug and play in probably like 20 of the 30 NBA teams, whereas you just have a smaller market for, you know, how many teams in the NBA really need a starting point guard right now? How many teams in the NBA really need a starting center right now? And it's just a harder conversation to have. The problem with trading Bogey, obviously, is that you're not going to get anyone back that, you know, is better. and then at least for the Jazz next season. And so, you know, trading Bogey is really the point where you have to choose a direction and you have to choose, do you want to take a step back next year in order to retool and rebuild and get younger? Or do you want to, you know, if you're going to trade Bogey, do you also trade one of Rudy or Donovan in order to get, you know, to go that direction and, you know, start frankly losing games and kind of rebuild in totality? So, you know, it's a tough situation right now. And that is definitely like the angst in the Jazz's locker room, in the Jazz's front office, excuse me, is like, you know, as Danny Ainge is kind of coming into a really tough situation because there has been some asset mismanagement from the Jazz. And, you know, honestly, they went all in and it didn't work. And so, yeah, they don't have a lot of future assets right now that can help kind of make these deals go along.
You brought up the Juancho Hernangómez contract, and it was incredible to see really him land and play out the year. Number one, what do they end up doing with Juancho? Number two, how did Juancho end up as a star in an Adam Sandler film?
The Adam Sandler bit is funny. Like, just they kind of picked him out, and he just got a phone call one day, which is kind of a crazy way, you know, for someone to all of a sudden be drafted into a movie. But that's what happened with Juancho. But yeah, truly a great story. You know, so Juancho's making $7 million next year, but it's non-guaranteed. It fully guarantees on June 30th this week on Thursday. So it basically what, you know, they're going to have to make a decision is, do you want to keep Juancho's next deal or, you know, next year, or do you want to have the, you know, basically save the luxury tax money? And it's going to be an interesting question. You know, we have seen this team trade away salary in order to save luxury tax money in several moves over the last year, whether that's like Mie Aone. You could go back to obviously Derek Favors, Ed Davis, and even the Joe Ingles trade, right? They saved a little bit of salary. Waiving him would make some sense. The problem was he was pretty good in a Jazz uniform last year. So maybe you waive him and then sign him to a new deal where, you know, you're using some of the mid-level exception on him if you want to go in that direction. Like, I could see it kind of going either way, and I truly don't know what to expect with Juancho, but I do think that, like, what the Jazz do with him on the 30th is kind of going to be a bellwether for what you're looking for in terms of the direction of the team. You know, do they want to continue to spend money on guys like Juancho, and kind of, you know, kind of contending, role players? You know, Juancho makes sense as a pretty decent ninth guy, or do you want to say, hey, that's not the direction we're going. We need some flexibility. And they go elsewhere, right? So it's going to be interesting. I truly have no idea what to expect with Juancho, but like, it will be a bellwether for sure.
I guess they've been making it work for a while, and you can tell that there's some issues there. And I don't know if it's Rudy and Donovan per se, or if it's Team Rudy and Team Donovan that can't seem to coexist with each other. You know, the camps and the marketing arm of each one of them, but after an offseason where it really feels like You know, we all just kind of feel like Rudy could be gone and a little bit surprised if he does come back. Can these guys make it work if they do run it back in terms of being able to coexist in the locker room?
They'll try.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's all good until you get punched in the face, right? Like, I think that's kind of what we've learned about Rudy and Donovan over the last few years. It's like, okay, you know, when things are going well, like they were in 2020, and you can win an incredible number of games, and they are a good pairing. When you run into any sort of, you know, in terms of just problem, you have stuff like the fourth quarter lost leads. You have stuff like them sniping at each other in the media. You have, frankly, like you pointed out, like the marketing arms and agents and, you know, family members and all that, like kind of bickering at each other in the scenes. You have an incredibly tough job for an incoming coach, especially if the young one, you know, like, to kind of deal with that situation and deal with egos in his first year in the job. You know, like, I think it's not that, you know, I think ultimately, like, Donovan and Rudy are pretty pragmatic people, and, like, I think they can play together when things are good. But, you know, I think we just saw last season so frequently what happens when things aren't good, and when, you know, you have a COVID month like January, or you lose an important locker room voice like Joe Ingles, or, you know, you have someone say something at the wrong time, or just have a disappointing loss. And, you know, I think, like, it would be okay. You know, I don't think they're, like, going to fight each other or anything, like, in, you know, with fists, but yeah. Are they, is it going to be comfortable for anybody the whole time? No, it's not. And, you know, at some point it does just feel like, hey, you know, you went all in on this core, you know, and that made sense to do, but it's not working out. And so pivoting is probably the smart move. It's just, yeah, can you get kind of fair assets in return in order to make that pivot?
So to revisit what NBA executives and what you feel like the vibe is, do you feel like the Jazz are bluffing when they say, yeah, we'll run it back and we'll win 45 to 48 games again next year and we'll be just fine? Do you believe that the Jazz actually believe that they're willing to do that?
I think they're short-term believe that. I think they're long-term bluffing, right? So I think they would be okay with getting through, like, the next month and next few months even without necessarily trading one of Donovan or Rudy. But I do think it's kind of basically a Ben Simmons situation. And I'm not saying either one of those guys are going to sit out games like that, but it might be more like Jimmy Butler with Minnesota. You know, you just, like, or Philadelphia for that matter, like, it's just not something that the team wants to deal with long term, that they're going to wait for a good return on their deal and see what kind of opportunities exist in the trade market. Danny Ainge is a really really good negotiator when it comes to these kind of trades and getting these kind of deals done, but I think he's also shown a willingness to kind of strike at the right time when the deal makes sense. And I don't think the Jazz are going to pivot just to pivot necessarily, and not get 40 cents on the dollar when they do. I think they would be willing to kind of go approach the regular season and, heck, maybe even the trade deadline with this and see where it goes, you know, and that's obviously not an ideal situation. And that means, like, if we're talking about the trade deadline, then that means four more months of this and kind of a franchise in stagnation a little bit. But heck, you know, I think that's probably a better outcome than taking, you know, a bad deal or taking back pieces that don't make sense for the future. You know, like a Nikola Vucevic deal doesn't help the Jazz short or long term.
So, Andy, Scotty and I got to sit down with Jazz owner Ryan Smith last week for a conversation. Had a blast with him. And Scotty asked him what it's like dealing with the fervor of social media. And he picked up on it really quick. And he said, all right, let's do it. Just talk about the Jazz jerseys. Let's do it. And he just goes into it. And I'm curious, what's been the response that you've seen? And did the Jazz get this way wrong? Are they way off track here? How do you feel about what they've released and how they've released on these jerseys?
The jerseys are bad. Nationally, I mean, it's not just Jazz fans. It's not just, you know, crazy, you know, people like me getting at it. It's like nationally, the Jazz messed this up. Like they, I think I used the word laughing stock in my piece, and I think that's accurate. Like, you just look at the people's reaction to the Jazz's jerseys, and it's uniformly negative. From, you know, guys who love jerseys really, you know, like Uniwatch and some of the kind of longstanding uniform watchers out there who are kind of tracking which jerseys are good and which ones aren't, to even, you know, just like average basketball fans out there who are like, you know, what is this? I think they messed it up. And, you know, I told Ryan that, obviously I wrote that in an article, and then I ran into him at an RSL game last weekend and, you know, kind of had a similar conversation with him. And I, like you said, like, I give Ryan props for, you know, being a billionaire that, you know, he was walking to a suite while I was walking to my seats in Rio Tinto, but like, he was willing to have that conversation. And we talked for 5 minutes about kind of what the limitations were of, you know, he talked about how, hey, Nike didn't approve the first kind of designs or color schemes 1, 2, and 3, you know, they said, hey, this one looks too much like Brooklyn. Hey, this one looks too much like Sacramento. So you can see, like, okay, this was not anybody's first choice. And then, you know, I think he said, you know, and I thought that was pretty clear with how the team released them by focusing on the purple uniform, which, by the way, is actually good, and, you know, kind of shunting the black, white, and yellow stuff to the bottom of the press release, to the end of the video, and so on. So, I think essentially it's an own goal. You know, it's a mistake that didn't have to be made. You know, I think it was a case of the Jazz hiring some new designers to kind of put in a fresh vision and them going too far with it. And, but that being said, you know, like, I think that criticism is fair there. I think, like, that they had the understanding that this was received badly is a good thing, and kind of pivoted to purple like they did was a good sign. And we'll see how quickly they can change it or improve on these jerseys. You know, like, I think there are, like, kind of black, white, and yellow uniforms that do make sense. You look at kind of some of the fan designs out there, and there's some decent looking ones. There are some pretty good looking ones, but just kind of what we ended up with was non-ideal by nearly everyone's estimation.
Well, Andy, we could do this all day, man. We appreciate it. Thanks for stopping by.
Seriously, Andy, thank you.
Always good to catch up, and let's do it again soon, all right?
Sounds good. Thank you, guys.
You got it. Andy Larson. Follow him on Twitter at Andy B. Larson, Jazz beat writer, and a lot of other things for the Salt Lake Tribune. Does a really good job.
I'm Dave Cauley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now, too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.